DW Africa Link.
Killing animals for sport. I just wonder how that is connected to conservationism. Now, I know animal lovers will not be happy about this, but let's break down some figures. In South Africa, last year, more than 30,000 wild animals were killed by thousands of international trophy hunters, mostly from the US and Europe. Some paid as much as $35,000 to shoot a white rhino. Unfortunately, sometimes the hunter becomes the hunted. Recently, an American trophy hunter in South Africa was fatally gored by a Cape buffalo he was tracking. The shocking tragedy has sent ripples through the game hunting community and reignited fierce debate over the ethics and realities of game hunting in South Africa. So, who truly benefits from this industry? Is it wildlife preservation, local communities, or trophy hunters themselves? That's what's coming up. I am Eddie Micah Jr., and this is Africa Link, the podcast that connects you to the stories that matter.
Africa Link, every weekday, here on DW.
South Africa's game hunting industry walks a thin line between conservation success and controversy. It's legal and tightly regulated, governed by national laws. Hunters need specific permits for each species, valid licenses, and must be accompanied by licensed professional hunters. Trophy hunting brings in about $54 million a year, but most of that goes to wealthy landowners, while nearby communities remain poor. Now, the government wants to grow the industry to over $1 billion by 2036. That could mean killing nearly 100,000 animals annually, a scale conservationists say is neither ethical nor sustainable. Let's get more from Ian Mikla, a graduate of sustainability from the Institute of Stellenbosch University. He's also a conservation author and an eco-tourism operator. DW correspondent in South Africa, Diane Hawker, is also here with us. Hello, both of you. Welcome to Africa Link. Diane, let's start with this. How has the recent killing of an American trophy hunter sparked debate about game hunting in South Africa?
Well, I think it's a debate that comes around every few years that we see whenever there's some kind of incident. In this case, an American trophy hunter who was killed by a buffalo. In the past, there's been incidents where, you know, trophy hunters have photographed themselves and posted their pictures on the internet. People have seen that and questioned why they are coming to South Africa to do this kind of trophy hunting. But I would say that in South Africa, it is quite a polarized topic because there are those people who believe that trophy hunting is an important part of the tourism sector. It's something that has been going on for years. And of course, not only in South Africa, there are a number of countries in this region that do have trophy hunting. And then there are conservation groups who believe that trophy hunting is anathema to the idea of conservation, that you cannot say that you are conserving and killing at the same time. And you see, you know, when incidents like this come up, these conversations kind of picking up momentum and questions being asked about whether South Africa should continue on the path that it is or change its perspective. But I think with a lot of things, this is also a discussion that involves money. And when you look at trophy hunting, it is an industry that does generate a lot of income. So there is always the question about, if it were to be cancelled or removed from the tourism sector, what impact that would have on the people in that sector. And that also tends to be a significant part of the discussion, particularly because the tourism sector is quite an important pillar of the South African economy. But also, like, when it comes to trophy hunting, the kind of figures that we're talking about are significant. I had a look at some of the packages that are available for some game hunting organizations, mm-hmm. and they're charging primarily in dollars. They're charging packages that range from, you know, 1 or 2 days to 11 days. And they're charging significant amounts of money. Like there was one that I saw that was 21,000 USD, and that is to kill certain types of animals. Mm-hmm. And there's others that are less, depending on whether there's one hunter, two hunters, whether you are, you know, a trained hunter yourself or you're just accompanying. So there's a whole ecosystem that exists. And I think that's why it tends to be that kind of a contentious discussion, because once you start kind of touching areas that have to do with people's pockets, then it does become, you know, quite a touchy subject. But also in a country that does rely on tourism a lot and that does also have an unemployment issue, these factors become quite a difficult debate. And I'm sure our guest will also contribute more to that debate.
I don't know what you make of that, Ian. I mean, is this the way to go? What do the numbers say? Is the conservation aspect of this really working with game hunting being allowed, being legal in South Africa?
There are a number of different forms of hunting. Sustainable hunting, which our traditional hunter-gatherer communities once engaged in, meat or biltong hunting, and that is, you know, small private farms who have a small offtake or a cull, if you wish, of a few antelope a year. And the animals are skinned and the meat is shared. Private farms who are breeding animals in captivity to be hunted by trophy hunters. That is a significant portion of the hunting. And I think that's where some of our debate is going to be focused today. That goes by the name of captive hunting, canned hunting, high fence hunting, ranch hunting. It has a whole number of different names. But here's the crux. It's always taking place on private property. South Africa is one of the few African countries that still has the majority of its land in the hands of private land ownership. And that's a crux to this debate. And then, of course, we get trophy hunting or in what's regarded as fair chase conditions. And so in South Africa, there are pretty few areas that fair chase hunting takes place. That needs vast extended natural areas. So to the north of us in parts of Zimbabwe, Botswana, up into Tanzania, where you've got big natural areas that are protected and the animals have an even or better than even chance of escaping the hunter. That's what we call fair chase hunting.
I think it's very good points that you made there. Although, I mean, if you ask conservationists, most of them at least, whether they're legal, sustainable, protected one or the private one, which obviously will be worse. So you're right to point that out.
Yeah.
They still just find that it doesn't make sense to have even what you call a so-called sustainable game hunting because they don't see how conservation works hand in hand with that. What do you make of that argument?
I understand the need for culling as a form of management in our protected areas, particularly if they are smaller confined areas. But then culling will need the input and advice and direction of the proper authorities, so the scientists and the researchers, not the trophy hunting community. Am I in favor of using trophy hunting as a form of conservation across Africa? No, I am not. There are significant ecological detrimental impacts of trophy hunting. It has very little, if any, social benefits. And the economic benefits are minuscule when compared to other alternatives. So, no, I don't see trophy hunting as an effective conservation tool. Let's just put that in context. Remember that many of Africa's national parks and protected areas were created because the colonial hunters were overkilling the big species. That's how they came into existence. Places like Kruger, places like the Selous, you know, even in Zimbabwe. So they were overhunting. Yes, there was the ivory hunters also involved. But back then, 100, 150 years ago, there was no poaching as such. There were still communities living off the land. But the wildlife was being hunted out by the trophy hunting industry. So that's the great irony, is that these places were protected to ensure that there was a supply, an ongoing supply of wild animals to kill for these so-called sport hunters. That has been twisted now, and it gets used as a justification for hunting in that, oh no, it's because we are conservationists. No, we had to create those protected areas to stop them for actually hunting every last animal out of existence.
Right. That's an interesting point. So just to be clear, from a biodiversity standpoint or from a conservation standpoint, are there any conditions that can make game hunting be conservative?
No, not really. I don't believe so. In fact, I believe the if the trophy hunting industry was left to their own devices, they would shoot the very last animal, because they cannot tell you or me when they will stop shooting. They've been doing it for, 150 years now? And when they started doing it, there were 150,000, 200,000 lions across Africa. There were possibly over 500,000 elephants. There were rhino in the hundreds of thousands. There were leopards, possibly close to 1 million. Okay, so now we're 200 years down the line. And if it was a successful conservation tool, many of these species wouldn't be under threat in the way that they are. So the graph of the number of animals that get killed continues to go up, but the number of animals in existence, their population, continues to decline. And in the same period of time, we've also lost vast percentage of the territory or the ranges of all these animals, lions, elephants, rhinos, leopards, you name them. If you look at a map 200 years ago where they occurred, and you look at a map today where they occur. So it has failed completely as a so-called conservation tool. Now, I'm not saying that other alternatives have done much better, but what I am saying is that if you're looking at it as a straight metric, it doesn't work, it hasn't worked. The numbers don't add up. Right. And if you look at the implications, when you look at gene pool, you look at the disruption to social dynamics, you look at the disruption to its resilience levels of specific species and populations, those are severe in some instances. Because if it's left to the trophy hunter, they will take out the gene pool. They will take out the biggest, the fittest, the strongest. And that actually is what you and I and everyone else in this world is trying to protect, the right. gene pool. They're going after the gene pool. That is a significant ecological detrimental factor to trophy hunting.
Right. Thanks for that, Ian. I mean, Diane, from all that we've heard Ian say, I wonder what the strong argument from the government is. I mean, it seems to me that the only way they can give thumbs up to game hunting is the fact that they make a lot of money from it. Or is there any other sort of evidence from the government side that suggests that it is actually helping with conservation efforts?
Well, from the government side, I would say that they are more speaking to it from a tourism economic perspective. And then you also have various groups that are within the hunting community, and they are the ones that are coming with some of these arguments about making sure that population sizes don't, overrun a particular area. I would say that it's more of a balance of that. So, it's important to understand that even within the South African government, it's really operating within a kind of a global industry to a certain extent. They have to, in some way, strike a balance. I wouldn't be able to say whether they are striking the balance correctly, but they do have to strike a balance between the interests of the those who are on the sort of more conservation side, who often argue that the quotas are too high or have criticized quotas for particular animals. So, for example, in 2023, the government was taken to court over certain quotas where conservationists were saying that the quotas for leopards and I think for rhinos, elephants, were too high and that they needed to be decreased because these are endangered species.
And it sounds to me it's all about the money, unless, of course, there's some sort of empirical evidence that hunting income somehow contributes, significantly to anti-poaching or habitat protection. Is there some sort of positive in there somehow?
So I first want to contextualize some of what Diane has mentioned. And I think, and this is very important in the South African context. So first of all, let's deal with hunting on private land. Now, the hunting that takes place on private land it's pretty much outside of the jurisdiction or control of government authorities. These are farms that have been bought and or have been hunting farms for generations, decades and decades. More recently, some of them have converted from being cattle farmers or maize farmers to hunting, or they've converted a portion of their farm to trophy hunting. Now, what's important to remember here is that, in fact, these guys are mostly businessmen and agricultural-based backed people. They are not scientists and conservationists. So breeding wild animals and buffalo, and typically they choose to breed high-value species. So they breed buffalo, they breed lions, they breed sable antelope, rhino used to be a favorite. So kudu, any animal that has a desirable trophy is what they breed. Now, those properties, it's very hard to justify or allow them to claim any conservation credentials, because what they are in fact doing is they're putting up fences around their farm and they are breeding those specific animals only for hunting purposes. There's no biodiversity conservation involved there. And if you define the definition of conservation, it involves the protection of the entire spectrum of biodiversity that occurs in habitats. It involves taking down fences and extending habitats to make areas larger, for species to move, for gene pools to integrate and to cross-pollinate. It does not involve putting up fences and breeding select number of animals for their monetary value, and then to remove all other animals that may be impacting their investment. So small predators like jackals and caracals will be killed, exterminated, because they take the young of the sable or the buffalo that the farmer he's been breeding up for his trophy hunter.
Right.
That has got nothing to do with conservation. So that's the first thing I want to point out. There are wonderful examples in South Africa of the private sector involved in conservation initiatives, but they do not rely on trophy hunting. So Tswalu, Pinda, the Sabi Sand, these are all Sambonani, these are all places that are involved in private sector conservation initiatives, but they don't use trophy hunting. Okay, so that's an important contextual point. The other thing that I think Diane is referring to here is that there are a number of smaller protected areas in South Africa that are run by government, but mostly local provincial authorities. So maybe what you might know as a state level, at a province level here. And these have been mismanaged, badly run for decades by government. Okay. And now what's happened is that they are underfunded and they are underpoliced. And so now they are looking at other ways, or at ways of raising money for these areas. And so our natural heritage, our wildlife populations are having to pay the price for poor management, corruption, and underfunding.
And then I'm just, you know, thinking while you're saying all of this, right, is what some call green hunting, right? First of all, how would you define green hunting? And on a larger scale, is that some sort of ethical alternative, you think?
Personally, I don't think so. But at best, I think you could argue that the jury is still out on green hunting. What is it? It's a form of outdoor activity where the so-called hunter gets to stalk and track and get up really close to whatever species is involved, so lion and elephant. They then, instead of using a weapon to kill the animal, they use a weapon to dart the animal. So the animal goes down under a drug and under an anesthetic, and they either get to have their photograph taken or they get to place a collar on the animal, which then becomes part of a research project. The photograph gets taken and, you know, 3, 4, 5 minutes later, under the supervision of a veterinary scientist, the animal then gets the drug gets reversed and the animal gets to get up and move away again. So it's not lethal. But here's the stats on this is that the demand for green hunts is marginal. I mean, it's very, very few get sold annually. And the reason for it is that people hunting, trophy hunting is about killing the animal. It's about taking the trophy home. It's about the bragging rights that come with a big male lion with big heavy elephant tusks, with a large set of sable or kudu horns.
Right.
They don't want a piece of paper that now gets a computer readout of where the animal that it darted has been moving over the last 6 months. Mm. There's no bragging rights really in that. That is not the essence of what trophy hunting is about. Trophy hunting is about the thrill of the kill and about taking that animal's head and body parts and displaying it.
Right. Diane, one of the arguments being made is that the money that is made from the hunting fees is used for the local or rural communities that these animals are in. Is there any evidence to prove that's what's going on in South Africa's case?
You know, that was one of the things that I think was the most difficult to find a definitive answer on, because it is a claim that's made quite often. Mm. You know, there's numbers kind of bandied about saying that trophy hunting will be able to bring in so many millions, but how do they kind of get to that figure? And it does seem that even within the communities, there are disputes about how beneficial it actually is. In some areas in KZN, there are some game farms that do work with communities, and they primarily, if there's meat kind of left over, would give it to the chief. But there are questions also about the distribution of that. Is it actually fair distribution within that community? And then there's also outright denials to say that the benefits to the communities are not really as significant as some of the advocates are saying. Yes, there are some small groups within the communities who might have jobs, like, for example, those working on the private farms where they do hunting. But the broader community impact has been difficult to measure. I tried to find, you know, any studies that had data on this. I found one from 2018, which seemed to be the most recent one that I could find, which was published in the Global Ecology and Conservation Journal. And they had said at the time when they looked at it, they looked at a number of factors. They looked at things like funding, that money that went to the game farm itself, transport in South Africa, accommodation, food, various things, that the number was about $341 million, which they say represents a potential loss to the economy should trophy hunting cease to exist. That being said, is that an amount that can be said to be so significant that if trophy hunting were removed, it wouldn't be kind of found in other areas within the tourism ecosystem?
But governments have to step up. They have a dual mandate when you get elected. It is to develop your rural communities. It is to empower your population, and it is also to protect biodiversity. And you can't neglect both and then suddenly ask the private sector through trophy hunting to fulfill both mandates. That is absolutely absurd thinking.
Got it. Diane, as we wrap up, what is the way forward in terms of really making sure that conservation is the top priority here?
Well, I think conservationists like Ian will definitely continue with the work that they've been doing. There are a lot of really active conservation groups in South Africa who regularly give input on things like the quotas that are given by government, different forms of legislation that's before parliament, even the updating of different gazetted policies. The changing of policy is slow work. It's definitely not something that happens over time.
Oof, what a discussion. I got to say, I feel like I've been in a lecture hall. Ian Mekla, a graduate of sustainability from the Institute of Stellenbosch University, conservation author and an eco-tourism operator. Also, many thanks to you, DW correspondent in Southern Africa, Diane Hawker.
Africa is changing. Don't get left behind. Tune in to Africa Link.
Now, unlike South Africa's provincial system, countries like Botswana and Namibia use strong national controls with set hunting seasons, quotas, and community-based conservation that shares benefits locally. Kenya, on the other hand, banned all sport hunting back in 1977 to prioritize wildlife protection over revenue. Now, these different approaches across Africa reveal the ongoing tension between generating income, conserving wildlife, and addressing the ethics of trophy hunting continent-wide. So what do you think? Your voice is crucial in shaping this debate. So share your thoughts with us on our Facebook page, DW Africa. Listen to us on Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts. Don't forget to click follow and subscribe to our DW Africa YouTube channel so you never miss an episode. This show was co-produced and edited by Isaac Mugabe. And I am Eddie Micah Jr. Thanks for listening.
DW News.
Here are today's top news stories and why they matter. 8 African nations, Nigeria, Burkina Faso, Ivory Coast, Kenya, Malawi, Mozambique, Tanzania, and Uganda are leading the rollout of the world's first malaria treatment tailored for newborns. With nearly 30 million babies born annually in malaria-endemic regions, health experts are calling this a potential game changer. DW's Frank Yeager reports from Uganda on this rollout.
The new treatment is being introduced in selected health facilities across Uganda. Health officials are optimistic that this breakthrough could significantly reduce the country's malaria-related deaths, particularly among children under 5. According to the Public Health Institute, malaria claims the lives of approximately 3,650 children in this age group every year. Unlike traditional treatments involving tablets and injections, Professor Richard Idro, a pediatrician and researcher at Makerere University, explains the new formulation allows infants to receive the medication in liquid form mixed with water or juice. The approval of this first ever malaria drug for newborns has sparked excitement among many Ugandans.
It's a relief because sometimes holding babies when they're taking those injections, it will take two. And sometimes the baby is very ill, the temperatures are bad, and you're taking some more time to prick their veins, and sometimes you find doctors that are not too experienced and they're taking time and the baby's life is at risk.
The pain that we've been subjecting to our children, that is 5 years below, I realize that they do cry while in hospitals, and sometimes even parents become lazy to take their children. And as even when it comes to monitoring, by the way, some people, even getting to hospitals, it is very hard to reach to some hospitals. I'm also in those hospitals that are very, very deep, hard to reach areas. So if such an innovation is really coming on board, we must embrace it as parents.
Well, I feel like it's inspiring, it's motivating, it's taken a while, but yeah, it's never too late, right? Better late than never. We are grateful because as a mother or any other person out there, when your child is going through pain, you feel a lot. So now it's just a matter of drinking. But I feel it's not just about the children. They should make something for the adults as well.
The deadline for a peace agreement between the Democratic Republic of Congo's government and the M23 rebel group expired on Monday. The two sides had signed a declaration of principles in Doha on July the 19th, aiming to finalize a deal by August the 18th. Although the deadline has passed, Qatari officials say both parties have responded positively to a draft agreement and are willing to continue negotiations. Why does this matter? Fresh fighting has erupted in eastern Congo, with M23 rebels intensifying attacks near Mulamba and maintaining control over strategic cities like Goma and Bukavu. The missed deadline risks escalating the conflict, but the draft agreement offers a fragile opportunity to halt the violence if both sides commit to action. Hundreds of journalists and media workers marched along Cape Town's Sea Point Promenade on Sunday, condemning the targeted killings of Palestinian journalists in Gaza. The protest follows the death of 6 media workers, including 4 Al Jazeera staff, in an Israeli airstrike near Al Shifa Hospital on August the 10th. Why does this matter? The demonstration highlights growing global concern over press freedom in Gaza. With over 200 Palestinian journalists reportedly killed since October 2023, the targeting of media professionals threatens independent reporting and silences critical voices in the conflict. And finally, European Union leaders are in Washington on Monday for high-stakes talks with Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky and U.S. President Donald Trump. The meeting follows Trump's controversial summit with Russian President Vladimir Putin in Alaska. Why does this matter? Trump is pushing for a peace deal that excludes Crimea and NATO memberships for Ukraine, positions that align with Moscow's demands. Monday's meeting is seen as a pivotal moment to reassess Western support for Ukraine amid intensifying Russian aggression. And that's all we had time for today. Don't forget to leave a comment, share, like, and subscribe to our channel, DW Africa. I'm Lucy Riley.
DW, made for minds.